I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are doing one of our Sunday live streams on Saturday. They've been so popular on Sunday, we decided to do it on Saturday. Well, actually, no. I actually am going under the knife tomorrow, Sunday. It's nothing terribly scary. And I didn't want to miss doing one live stream this weekend. So I found out that the writer's block was only going 1 hour this evening. So I said, okay, I'd like to come in for an hour after the writer's block and do an Ask Me Anything. So you can ask me anything. And if you want to leave a comment or question or donation through Entropy, go to entropystream.live/countercurrents without the hyphen, and you can leave your super chat there. Just hit the green button. It says we're not streaming. We aren't streaming through Entropy. We're streaming through DLive. Smash the green button, leave your donation, leave your comment, leave your question, and I will get to it. So I want to begin by thanking a bunch of people who have sent donations recently. And I will just give an initial or a single name or a nickname or whatever, not to dox anyone. So Quinn gave $240. Thank you very much. Jay gave $1,083.81. Russ gave $40. Bats gave 40. Mike gave 105. Andrew gave 50. Moreland 23. Moncrief 200. Thank you. Tony 100. Ors $30.30. Rick gave 60. Rory 20. Hamburger Today gave 25. Brandon gave 10. DS gave 100. Sean gave 1,000. TSZ gave 100. TJ gave 30. Wyatt 150. Red 150. 14 words 175. David gave 500. That's very generous. Jeff gave 50. Julian 40. I got a $40 donation from somebody completely anonymous whose name I will give as Cash. Bill gave 25 and Francis XB gave $19.84. That's symbolic, I imagine. And Manning gave 100. Elliot 20. Ned 100. Kathleen 100. Elliot, another Elliot, I believe, or maybe another from Elliot at 20. Buckley gave $1,000, very generous. Freeman gave 100. Jameson 500. Monaghan 150. Monert gave $500, very generous. We received an anonymous crypto donation for $52.24. Sally gave $1,000. Phil gave $105. We also received from Niels a $50 donation. And this was in the name of the great god Ingwe. Tut 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 gave $20. And we have two $20 donations from Gadius Maximus with questions attached. So this is all very exciting. We're off to a very good start, everyone. So I want to hop right into a couple of the questions that I've gotten. Some of these questions they're difficult. They require a lot of thought. So I got a few over the past week, and I want to just go to those first, and then we'll look at the ones that have come in this afternoon and evening. So the first question is actually something left over from last week. What is up with the lawsuits after my almost expulsion from Norway? Well, a little more than a year ago, as you will recall, I was detained in Norway and put in a jail for the weekend. And then I was not expelled from the country, as it turns out. They didn't actually deport me, but I took the free deportation flight anyway, because, well, free you can't argue with free. But anyway, what happened was this. Some Antifa in Norway were bent out of joint because I was speaking at the Skanza Forum. And the topic of the Skanza Forum meeting was human biodiversity. And I was going to speak on the topic on the very idea of white privilege. Now, somehow the Norwegian secret police, the police security service, determined that my speech would cause violence if people heard it. They didn't know the name of the speech or the topic of the speech, but through their infinite wisdom and psychic powers, based on reading an Antifa blog, they determined that I was a danger to the public. And so for the first time, as far as we know in Norwegian history, somebody was detained to prevent him from speaking because of what other people might do if he actually spoke. It's rather extraordinary. And so the country was up in arms about this. And first of all, you have to hand it to these dummies. If they had just allowed my speech to go unmolested, I would have spoken to 100 people in Norway, and it would have been recorded, and a few thousand people would have heard about it. Instead, because of being arrested, I was the number one news story for the entire weekend in Norway. The number of visitors from Norway to Countercurrents went off the charts. And so the message that I was putting out and the message that the Skanza Forum was putting out was broadcast far wider to far more Norwegians and internationally than would have happened if we had just been unmolested. One of the people who heard about this and was outraged was a lawyer who actually had defended Varg Vikernes. This fellow is really the best known lawyer in the entire country of Norway. His name is J.C. Elden, and he took my case. And so he has filed an appeal to this process, basically. And it is slowly working its way through the Norwegian court system. I imagine I'll hear something from it. It took months, of course, for this to be actually filed and accepted. And so it'll probably take months before anything happens. So more than a year has gone by, but this is still an active case. And I am hoping that what goes on is this, that they reverse this finding from the police security service, but that somebody's head rolls, maybe a few heads roll, because what they did was so stupid. It's an embarrassment to the Norwegian Police Security Service, to the Norwegian government, and to the Norwegian nation, and really to everybody on the planet Earth. It was so stupid that they took basically words taken out of context in a malicious Antifa blog, and that dictated government policy. And that on the basis of this trumped up fake charge, I was prevented from speaking, which again, it's the first time this apparently has ever happened in the history of Norway. I don't know if they went all the way back to the Middle Ages. Maybe something like that happened in the Middle Ages, but nothing recently. Certainly nothing in modern Norwegian history. So this is an interesting story. Maybe I'm going on a bit long about it, but it is yet to finish. And I'm really hoping that we can drag some of these little worms who did this, especially the collaborators within the Norwegian government, the collaborators with Antifa that took quote-unquote intelligence, namely lies from Antifa, and basically put the imprimatur of the Norwegian government on it. That would be nice if these people get exposed and pilloried and humiliated. And I would love to go back to Norway. I can go back anytime. In fact, by the end of this whole weekend, they said, you don't even have to leave. You can stay here and take part in your legal appeal. Well, I didn't want to do that because Norway's the most expensive country in Europe. It's the land of the $25 salad. So I didn't really relish the thought of staying on much longer where I wasn't welcome. So anyway, I can go back, and I will go back. I will go back, especially if I get the Nobel Peace Prize. But anyway, enough about that. So let's look at some other questions. Alex, last week, wrote to me and asked me, what are my favorite movie soundtracks? I'm a big music buff, so that was a good question. And I had to think about this for a while, and I came up with a pretty good list. I think, this is a defensible list. These are my personal favorites, but I think that there's a lot to recommend these to you as well. But some of these choices are based on sentimental reasons, but they're still good. My very favorite film score is Ben-Hur by Miklos Roja. This music was something I heard when I was a kid. I heard it on TV, and it really, really marked me. It stamped me. It made a strong impression. This is what music should sound like, and it's extraordinarily good music. I really love Howard Shore's soundtrack for The Lord of the Rings, all three of those movies. John Williams's music in Star Wars is fantastic. I particularly like The Empire Strikes Back. Bernard Herrmann's score for Hitchcock's Vertigo is one of the great film scores. It's my fourth favorite. Ennio Morricone, his score for The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is one of the most extraordinary scores ever written. There's music in there that literally gives me chills. It's so powerful. And it's also incredibly unusual music, too. It's quite remarkable. Toru Takemitsu wrote a magnificent soundtrack for Ran, which is the King Lear adaptation that was done by Kurosawa. It's truly extraordinary in every way, and the score is magnificent. Philip Glass, his best work, I think, is his score for Paul Schrader's movie Mishima. I'm very fond of that. Angelo Badalamenti's music for Twin Peaks, the pilot and the series, and also the movie that was done, Fire Walk With Me. It's all fantastic. Some of my favorite movie and TV soundtrack music. I also very much love Once Upon a Time in the West by Ennio Morricone. Again, some of the music in there literally can give me chills. It's so powerful. And then Born Free, the music by John Barry. I've loved that music ever since I was a kid when I first heard it. It's just absolutely magnificent, and it's still powerful to this day. And so I thought, well, why not just give Alex two lists for the price of one? So I thought, well, who are the best film composers, right? Not particular scores, but composers, because the list is a little different. So this is my ranking. Miklos Roja, number one, fantastic composer, very much in the Central European style. He was a Hungarian, and he also wrote a lot of orchestral music, chamber music. He was a composer in the classical tradition. He's my top favorite. John Williams is number two. He's done so many absolutely magnificent melodies. He's a truly amazing guy. He's 88 years old, and he's still working, which is truly remarkable. Ennio Morricone, who just died, I think, at the beginning of this year or late last year. I actually had the privilege of seeing him conduct his music with an orchestra and a huge chorus in Budapest, and it was absolutely fantastic. Bernard Herrmann, fantastic composer. Toru Takemitsu, very, very important composer. Primarily a classical composer, did orchestral pieces, songs, guitar pieces, lots of chamber music, and so forth. But he also did a very large number of fantastic soundtracks, mostly for Japanese directors. John Barry, who did the classic Bond scores, who did Out of Africa, who did Born Free, is a fantastic film composer. Nino Rota, who did The Godfather and the classic scores for a lot of Federico Fellini's best movies, is a great composer. Eric Wolfgang Korngold, he started out, again, as a concert composer, as a chamber music composer, as a classical composer. And then he went to Hollywood, and he did a number of classic scores in the 1930s. They're truly, really magnificent work. Henry Mancini did a lot of more jazz-inflected kind of pop music scores. but one of the great melodists and one of the great film composers. And Maurice Jarre, finally. I love his music for these widescreen, grand, epic films like Dr. Zhivago, for instance, or Lawrence of Arabia, to name two films by David Lean. He was a fantastically talented guy. So anyway, enough about film. So let's go over to Entropy and see if we have some new questions at Entropy. Tut, tut, tut. I mentioned he gave $20. Dear Greg, are you actually able to monetize all those diamonds, lemons, and ninjaginis? Do you add them to the countercurrents goal? Yes. I finally cashed out our diamonds and lemons and whatever account recently, and we received almost $1,800 towards our fundraiser goal. We're trying to raise $150,000 this year. That basically keeps us in print on the web, producing quote unquote content, ideas, propaganda. There are three people, really three and a half, now four and a half people who are employed full time or almost full time by Countercurrents. We've taken on Jim Goad. He's going to be doing two features a week. So he's our most prolific content creator or author. I hate that word content. You know, I always, whenever I use it, it's in scare quotes. So anyway, we are trying to raise $150,000 a year to keep us in the pink on the web. And we are about $25,000 from our goal, and we have about 25 days left. But we got $1,800 closer with all these poker chips, all this fake internet money that you've been giving through DLive. So thank you very much. So Gadius Maximus writes in with $20. Thank you. A philosophical challenge. You've written that you believe people have basic human rights that should be respected, and that in particular ethno-nationalism is a universal right belonging to all peoples and races. At bottom, doesn't this imply a sort of fundamental equality among individuals and the races? And there is a sense in which, yes, that's true. We all have the same rights. And so we're all, I guess, equal in that. I don't have any problem with that idea. If something is true of everybody, you can say it's equally true of everybody. So that doesn't really entail anything more in the form of equality than that. It certainly doesn't entail the idea that everybody is equal in all respects. It doesn't entail the idea that everybody is a good fit for the same society or the same family or the same sports team or whatever. And it certainly doesn't entail the idea that people need to be made more equal. So Gadius writes in with $20 more, a political challenge. If we recognize the validity of natural and social hierarchies, doesn't this also extend to countries? Won't there always be some country holding the ring of power, so to speak, making it a de facto empire? And if there is to be an empire, shouldn't we want it to be our country? Well, countries aren't all equal in certain ways. They're certainly not equal in terms of population. They're not equal in terms of the average genetic potential of their populations. The whole continent of Africa, for instance, doesn't have the genetic potential of Europeans or East Asians. That's a simple truth. However, there is this concept in international law of the sovereign nation. And international law basically treats all sovereign entities as equal in certain ways. It doesn't mean that they're equal in terms of their military power, their economic productivity, or whatever, but they're treated as equals in the same way that citizens of the same state are treated as equals because they have the same rights. And that's a sense of civic equality that we have. So unequal people can have equal rights, equal privileges within the same order, political order. And under international law, a sovereign state has equal rights. And so that is a fact, right? The United States is more powerful than Mexico, but Mexico and the United States are sovereign nations, and therefore they are on a certain moral level at parity with one another, with things like non-interference in one another's affairs and so forth, diplomatic rights, and so on, control over their internal spheres. To be a sovereign nation means that you don't have to answer to somebody else about your internal affairs. So does that mean, therefore, that we can live in a world without empires? Well, yeah. I mean, I don't like the idea of an empire. What is an empire? An empire boils down to the idea that one people or one nation exercises political power over another people or another nation. And that comes at the expense of the sovereignty of that other group. I think that if you believe in ethno-nationalism as I do, then you support the right of self-determination of all peoples. And where you don't see that existing, and you have people who wish to exercise self-determination, they're being wronged by that. So empire, by its very nature, is a crime, in my view. But I think the question here really hinges on a questionable assumption, which is that the most powerful nation is a de facto empire. That's just not the case. You can be an extremely powerful nation, and yet you can treat your neighbors as sovereign nations. There are some extremely tiny nations in Europe. The Republic of San Marino, Liechtenstein, Monaco. These sovereign nations are, first of all, they're among the oldest nations in Europe in some cases. They're among the most prosperous nations in Europe, and they're among the tiniest and most powerless nations in Europe. Now, if San Marino decided that they wanted to host a Russian Air Force base or something, the Italians would, of course, say no. And what would happen is, well, there would be a war. It would be a very brief war, right? The point is that San Marino is a tiny little city-state landlocked within Italy, and yet it's a sovereign nation. And it's certainly not as powerful as Italy. But for some reason, it's still there after all this time. Why? Well, one of the reasons why is that power politics is not the sole factor in determining international relations. And the people who like to talk in terms of empires, they also seem to have, I think, a reductionistic power politics, Machtpolitik view of international relations. The fact is that the nation with the biggest armies doesn't always triumph in every occasion, because we're not always fighting. People are trading. There are relationships of trade. There are relationships of amity between different nations. And I think that is a model that's ignored by assuming that the most powerful nation is also going to be a de facto imperial power. Now, of course, if you are a very small nation next to a very big nation, you can't really afford to piss them off all that much. But the fact remains is that until you go way too far and you end up in a war, you are still on, by international standards, grounds of equality as sovereign entities. Now, how do small nations resist the will of extremely big nations? Well, you may be the biggest. This is what a professor of mine said when I was an undergraduate. He was teaching Hobbes, and he explained what Hobbes meant by human equality in Leviathan. And basically what Hobbes meant by human equality is that no man is so powerful that he can't be killed. My teacher said, you might be some big, strong guy, but you gotta sleep sometime. And when you do, a bunch of us skinny guys are going to get together and stick a knife in you, and that'll be the end of you. That's how small nations resist big bullies. They band together. They create alliances. And so I think that if you look at history, you see that that is what happens. You see small nations existing sometimes very insecurely between larger empires or very large nations, but they still manage to maintain their independence. So I think that that is a possibility. So, but if there is going to be an empire, shouldn't you want it to be your country? Well, if it's a choice between being invaded or being the invader, it depends on the time horizon, right? Say that to the British vis-a-vis India in 1890. They'd say, "Oh hell yeah, we want to be the conqueror. We want to be the one with our boot on their neck, right?" Well, say it today. Who's conquered whom? The Great Britain is basically drowning in the genetic backwash of their grand empire. Most of the non-whites in Great Britain today are there based on the fact that they come from former imperial territories of the UK. So it depends on the time horizon, frankly. I would not prefer to be either. And if you are in the dominant mode of an empire, well, wait a few generations. You might find that you've had a rather dramatic reversal of fortunes. And at that point, maybe you should say, gosh, wouldn't it have been better if we had just left India alone? I'm sure some Britons think that. You know, it wasn't worth it. We could have bought the goddamn tea and curry without conquering the place, right? So anyway, I think that covers that. So Willie writes in with $50. That's very generous. Oh, by the way, everybody, we still have a matching grant. We have about $4,000 of a $10,000 matching grant left. So everything you donate during this stream will be matched. So it'll go twice as far. Willie writes, "Have you ever received a donation from a Cuban?" I don't know. You could be a Cuban, Willie, right? A lot of this stuff is anonymous. So yeah, we could have a Cuban in Cuba. I don't know. I don't know about that. I don't know if the Castro regime would even let that happen. As far as Cubans in the United States, Cuban Americans, yeah, I'm pretty sure we have. And we've received lots and lots of donations and book orders from people with Hispanic surnames in the New World and the Old. So that doesn't surprise me in the least. Empires will always exist. This is true. Crime will always exist as well. It doesn't mean that it's a good thing. Is Belarus an equal of what? It's an equal of Russia. It's an equal to its neighbors. It's not equally powerful, but it is definitely in the what they call the comity of nations. It is another sovereign nation. Ricky Vaughn had it coming. Well, Ricky Vaughn was mean to some crappy, low-class, trashy people, and he got doxxed. I don't think he had it coming, but I don't believe in doxing. I think it's a very bad thing. You're conflating the descriptive with the prescriptive. I don't know who's conflating what. You're thinking prescriptively, Greg, this is a descriptive issue. It's both, because prescriptions actually matter to how people operate in the world. People accept basic principles of international law. When they exchange embassies with one another, they're accepting basic principles of international law. These prescriptions matter. When one nation violates the territory of another, lots of other nations get angry about it. They do things like have sanctions and protests and so forth. Sometimes it will actually go to war over this. So these prescriptions matter. Has whatever happened, Greg? Well, anyway, they're under the dominion of the EU. Well, the EU, yes and no. The UK has left the EU. So Eat More Cabbage says, Gregorius, philosopher king. Well, I do love philosophy. And sometimes I think, yeah, I'd probably do things better than our current presidents and monarchs. Sometimes I do get into that. If I were president mode, there's such a thing as soft power too. But yeah, that is true. Okay, I just want to make sure I'm not missing. San Marino isn't a province of Italy. It's an independent city-state. It's been an independent city-state, a republic for a very, very long time, for 400, 600 years. Patrick Little is one of the few who consistently point out Israel's human trafficking operations. Well, that's fine. That's good. William Pierce used to do that. David Duke has pointed that out as well. The U.S. wields incredible soft power, yes, but you can say no to it. Imperialism is Zionism. Well, I wouldn't say that, but I would say Zionism. I don't even think Zionism can necessarily be described as imperialism. Zionism, when it was first created, was basically Jewish ethno-nationalism. And I'm all for that. I would love every Jew to live in Israel. I think the world would be a better place if Jews lived in Israel. And that's that's the original purpose of Zionism. Now, of course, the Zionists are trying to expand their territory where Jewish settlements and things like that. And so that is imperialism. And this is one of the reasons why the state of Israel will not be at peace. It will not stay within its borders. I mean, there are plenty of people who are pissed off that it has borders to begin with, but then to add insult to injury and to add to their enemies, they won't stay within their borders. It's a mess. It's a complete mess. But I would like to see a two-state solution with stable borders in that part of the world, because Palestinians are a people too. Palestinians exist as a diaspora, and I would like their diaspora to return to Palestine, an independent, sovereign Palestine, and the Jewish diaspora to gather in an independent, sovereign Israel. When have superpowers or regional powers not behaved like empires? Well, they've not behaved like empires when they are constrained by other empires or by other large powers or by blocks of smaller powers that want to preserve their independence, or by the acceptance of the norms of international law. That's what restrains them. All of your decisions as a small nation are informed by the perceived reaction of a larger power. Yeah, that's true. That doesn't imply that you aren't a sovereign entity. It just implies that you're a small sovereign entity that you have to worry. Just like if you're a short man, you have to worry about hanging around with tall men or stronger men. These are factors that have to be taken into account, because yes, power is a real thing, but it's not exactly always the case that the only thing that determines how you get on with, say, the people around you is who's stronger, right? That's generally something that happens when real amicable social relationships break down. Yeah, alliances is an admission of power politics. That's fine, but it's also a thing that sovereign nations contractually create amongst themselves. So the V4 will never be a serious rival to the U.S. The V4 refers to the Visegrad Group. The Visegrad Group is basically it's Hungary, Poland, the Czech Republic, and Slovakia. And after the collapse of communism, the Poles, Czechoslovakia, which was one nation at the time, and Hungary met together, and they decided they were going to create a bloc. They would share, military, intelligence, economic development, educational initiatives, and so forth. This was before these countries became part of the European Union. There are many people in Central and Eastern Europe who don't like NATO, they don't like the United States, and they don't like the European Union. They think that they are all vectors, basically, for ruining the racially and culturally healthiest part of Europe, which is basically the former Soviet bloc, ironically. And these countries are thinking of alternative ways of organizing to protect their collective interests, because they know that Russia is not their friend either. So they want a third option. most people say, you've either got to be aligned with Russia or you've got to be aligned with America, NATO, and the EU. Others are thinking in terms of this idea of Intermarium or the Three Seas Initiative. Basically, these are projects to create a political, economic, military alliance between all the former formerly communist states in Central and Eastern Europe to protect themselves against both Western Europe and against the Russians. And I think it's a very, very good idea. Will it ever be the V4 would be a seed of that. Will it ever be a serious rival to the United States? Well, all four of those countries can say no to the United States at any time. And they can say no quite a lot to the United States before they risk having NATO dropping bombs on them. And I think we're going to see them saying a whole lot more in the coming years. But also the idea that they will never be a serious rival to the United States, that sounds a little bit triumphalist, because the United States has passed its peak as a global power and it is in steep decline. I think 2020 was the meridian point. I think the U.S., 2020 will be known as the year that America died. I don't think the United States is going to be the global superpower that it is today in even 5 years' time. And all these countries, I think, are smart to think about how that they can secure themselves politically, militarily, economically, in a post-American world. Would be great if Greg put together an essential reading list. Yeah, that's actually a good idea. I read too much. I'd have to really, really slim it down. But that's a good project, and I will work on that. The UK hasn't been conquered by India. Well, yes, in a way it has. Not in a political sense, but demographically it certainly has. And in a culinary way, it certainly has. That's a fake narrative, Greg. The UK was under no obligation to import millions of Hindus. They were under no obligation to, yeah, but they did it anyway. They did it anyway, and the legal pretext and framework of that was basically connected with its former empire. Sad but true. Let's see, I just want to make sure that I'm not overlooking other people. An empire can only be so large before it becomes impossible to maintain. Yeah, so this is important, and this goes back to Gadius's original question. Let's just say that you want to think in terms of pure power politics. Okay. Let's say that you're the strongest guy and you beat everybody around you into submission and you rule over them. You are proclaimed the ruler. Well, how are you going to go about practically ruling? Well, you're going to have to find, because you've got to sleep sometime, right? And you've got to delegate certain things. You don't know everything. You can't watch everything. You can't be awake all the time like Sauron's eye. You're going to have to find people that you trust that will be your peers in effect. And these people will advise you. They will keep you safe when you're asleep. And in short, you're going to have to cede being ruler simply based on the greater threat to others and replace that principle with other forms of rulership, if you will, other things that keep you alive through the night. And those are going to be things like mutual trade, if you will, mutual respect. You're going to have to basically find other forms of getting along with people besides the ability to threaten their lives. Well, that's true of empires too. Imagine that you've created an enormous empire. Well, congratulations. Now you've got to figure out how to govern it. One of the ways that you govern things is you delegate authority. One of the ways that you govern things is to create peers who can advise you and who can tell you bad news. That's really the important thing, to be surrounded by people who can speak frankly to you when you're fucking up, right? That is a change from being the most, you know, ruling over people simply through fear, to existing in some ways on a level of equality with them. That's why monarchies and the most absolute monarchy will always give way in some way to an aristocracy. The king creates peers. And as you basically negotiate the necessities of rule, you're going to find that empire is going to start devolving. You're going to find that it's more practical to devolve certain powers to the provinces and so forth. And so you're going to find in the end that through a kind of dialectic, you're going to get practically to the point at which many countries exist today, which is that they are de facto independent. You're going to have de facto independent provinces if your empire actually submits to the necessity of, you know, political rule. So why not just dispense with all of this dialectic and just go straight there and just recognize you can't rule simply based on threats. You have to also have principles of equity, common norms, principles like trade, mutual benefit. These are other forms of political relationships besides just clubbing one another over the head. And even if you start out with, you know, the big empire ruled by one guy, you're going to find that that's not adequate and that you're going to have to bring in something other than just pure power politics. So let me move forward. Yeah, somebody says, Ian, no one's suggesting the V4 would remotely rival the U.S. or any other global power. Well, the U.S., you know, there's a lot of ruin in a nation. There's a lot of ruin in the U.S. The U.S. might not be all that in 5 years or 25 years. And the V4 or the Intermarium, some kind of Central East European cooperative project, might be a very powerful thing. You know, that's one thing that we learned from history. None of these great empires last forever. None of these big nations last forever. There are all these amazing reversals of fortune. There have been amazing reversals of fortune in the last 150 years. The Intermarium, just say if you took all the former Soviet republics like Ukraine, Belarus, the Baltic states, if you took the former Yugoslav republics, if you took all the former Eastern Bloc except for, I guess, East Germany, which is now part of Germany, but everything else, the former Warsaw Pact plus Yugoslavia plus the Baltics plus Belarus plus Ukraine, put those together, you would have an economic bloc that's larger in its population, in its gross domestic product, and its military potential than Russia. Just there. Russia is a sick man. It's a nation with a lot of serious problems. A lot of these other nations have serious problems too, demographic decline and so forth. But you put these all together into an economic and military alliance, and it's bigger than Russia already. Doesn't have nukes, but they can get nukes rather fast if need be. So it could be a serious factor, especially when you see the U.S. is in decline and also Western Europe is in decline. Eastern Europe might have problems, but Western Europe has a lot worse. It has a lot worse demographic problems, including a lot more non-whites. It's got a lot more debt. It's got a lot more instability. And the West is declining and the East is making good decisions. So the Intermarium could be much stronger than NATO, much stronger than Western Europe in 25 or 50 years, because they're going in the right direction and Western Europe is going in the wrong direction. These things can change. How do you predict the future? You look at the principles that rule in the present. Countries like Hungary and Poland are making the right decisions today. Those are going to have effects down the line. France, Spain, Germany, they're making all the wrong decisions, and those are going to have effects down the line. Yeah, the V4 seems to be a great place to start a European power center. Depends on whether the Poles and the Austrians have the balls. Well, Austria isn't really considered generally part of the V4, but I'm sure I have friends in Austria who love the idea of making it a V5 and going that way. But they're a minority in Austria, I'm afraid. Austria right now is very much West-oriented. Power dictates law, or paper dictates law, not power. Well, morality dictates law. Morality is one factor here that has to be taken into account. It's not just power. The state of Belarus is not a serious equal to Russia. Well, yes and no. Depends on what sense of equality you're talking about. They exchange diplomatic embassies. They're both sovereign nations, and therefore, in terms of international law, in terms of what's called the Comity of Nations, they're actually equals. They're not equals in population, GDP, military potential, or so forth. Okay, so we've got several more. First of all, I have a $3 donation from Lovecraft's Cat. And the question is, okay, this is based on obviously a discussion that was going on at the writer's block earlier. What are my favorite road trips and what is my road trip playlist? Okay, well, this is good. I will run through this very, very quickly. Okay, so several favorite road trips. One, Highway 1, the California coast, going south from San Francisco to Los Angeles. Fantastic. It's best to go south and north to south rather than south to north because you're in the outside lane going south and you're driving along the coast and it's really spectacular. It's absolutely beautiful. One of the most beautiful drives I've ever been on. Okay. Another great road trip I took was in 2016. My friend Ghoul and my dog and I drove clear across the country. We drove all the way from New York City to Seattle. And I have to say my favorite stretch of that journey was driving through North Dakota and Montana. I didn't realize North Dakota was so beautiful. It's an absolutely beautiful place. You know, sort of bleak and everything, but scenic and amazing. And Eastern Montana is scenic and magnificent in other ways, in the same way, really. And then you get to Western Montana, which is mountains, high mountains and pine trees and everything like that. It's all magnificent. So that was a great road trip. I really like that. I've taken two cross-country road trips between the Bay Area and Atlanta. And my favorite stretch of those trips was through northern New Mexico and northern Arizona. Absolutely magnificent landscapes. Music for road trips. Well, I remember really liking playing Rammstein on road trips. I kind of like sort of rock with a bit of grandeur to it. So my road trip playlist was stuff like Rammstein, Journey. I remember a lot of Journey, and Billy Idol, Death in June. We had some Death in June thrown in, some Simple Minds. I remember a lot of New Order, and I think some Kraftwerk got mixed in there too. So that's some of the stuff. Anyway, so let me go to the next one, which is Sunshine Kid. He's donated $13. Thank you. Thoughts on VDare's castle purchase and the ease with which they seem to fundraise. What are the prospects for a stable credit card processor fundraising method in the short term? Do you see yourself holding a conference in the castle? Great questions. Okay. Years ago, there was a property that popped up on my radar in Washington State. And it wasn't close to a major airport, unfortunately, and neither is the Vidir Castle, and that's one strike against it. But this was an amazing property. It was a huge house. It was a gigantic, I think it was like 5,000 square foot house on 19 acres of land. And it was sort of craftsman style, built in the like a 1911, 1912. Had a huge garage. Over the garage was like a full apartment. And then there was a building that was built next to it as a kind of dance hall. And it had two giant rooms, one stacked on top of another. And it also had a bathroom, you know, bathrooms for men and women, probably a handicapped bathroom too. I don't remember the details. You could have put a really good professional kitchen in there. And I was looking at this and thinking this would be an amazing headquarters, right? I just didn't have the money at the time. And I watched this thing for like 2 years and finally somebody bought it up and turned it into a winery. But anyway, that was the kind of thing I was thinking of at the time, because we were having trouble in 2010, 2011, 2012. Amarin was being run out of hotels. They ended up going to Montgomery Bell State Park in Tennessee, and they've been meeting there ever since. Other people I know, Vidir was having conferences canceled all the time. And so the idea was to find a venue that we would control that you could have a conference at. And this place in Washington State, you could have had a really good conference at. And there was so much land. You could have had, you know, you could have people camp out there in tents. There were hotels in the vicinity. You could put yurts up. There could have been lots and lots of ways. The house itself, you could have filled up with people. So you could have had fairly large events at that venue. So I was delighted when this castle idea popped up, because I thought this is the way to do it. And I would love to have some event at the Vidir Castle someday if they'd have me. Why does Vidir raise money better than Countercurrents? Well, look, Peter Brimlow is a rich guy. And his brother, he has a twin brother. And his twin brother runs a hedge fund. Peter is an investor. Peter used to be a financial journalist. Peter traveled around in, you know, high capitalist sets. He has amazing contacts with people. Also, Vidir is somewhat towards the center compared to Countercurrents. They're not cucky on immigration, but that is their main issue, right? And they just don't venture into a lot of the topics that Countercurrents ventures into. They don't really venture into hard-nosed race realist stuff like Amarin does, for instance. They really focus on immigration and America First, and they're really kind of conservative in their connections, right? And in the feel of the thing. So given the fact that the Brimlows are wealthy people, that means they've got lots of wealthy friends and wealthy associates. The line that they put out is fairly conservative. It's closer to the center than Countercurrents. We would never have Patrick Buchanan consenting to be syndicated by Countercurrents or Ann Coulter. That just wouldn't happen. It's just not within the realm of the politically possible yet. Okay. So they have a lot more success raising funds than us, because they're closer to the mainstream, and that's where the money is. So that means that the people who believe in what we're doing have to be a little more generous, because there are fewer of us, fewer of you. The people with more money, it's ironic. The people who have more money, well, they have money because they're clever with their money, and they play it safe oftentimes. The people who are closer to us, they have less money, but oftentimes are more generous with it. They're more willing to take risks. Well, because why? They're just less plugged into the system. And so I do think that Countercurrents is going to survive, though. Look, since May, we have not had any way of taking credit card donations except for Entropy. And we're still here. We have slowly trained our donors to write checks. And we have been working on cultivating larger donors to be more generous with us. We are going to be around. We're going to be around for a long, long time. And as things change and things are changing in our direction in the long term, simply because this system is making all the wrong decisions, right? Because things are changing in our direction, it's going to be easier and easier for us to support ourselves, even though the system is going to, again, make it harder and harder for you to donate with a credit card or whatever. I'm sure someday our bank accounts are going to be canceled and we'll have to find other accounts. There'll be no end to the troubles, and we're going to have to be like gypsies. You know, we can just pack everything up and move to another platform. We'll do that. They can't stop us. They're making all the wrong decisions. All the trends are basically pushing people in our direction. There will come a day when Countercurrents can raise money as well as VDare. So in the long term, I'm very optimistic. Okay, so I have another question here from Willie M. $50. Again, thank you so much, and that's being doubled. What are your thoughts on Jose Marti, a poet and philosopher? He is considered a Cuban national hero. I do not know anything about him. I'm ashamed to say it. I don't know. I'll add him to my list of people to look into. But thank you very much for the donation. Sunshine Kid, $25. How seriously do you take Spengler's prediction of the coming Caesarism? With the upcoming release of the Centennial Edition of Imperium, has Yaki's philosophy influenced your own? What value has his philosophy for us today? Well, Spengler, okay. Caesarism is a thing. There's no question about it. And Spengler wasn't the first person to notice it. The first people to notice it were the Romans, right? Sometimes republics morph into empires, and sometimes republics become ungovernable, and they need a strong man to keep things together. And that's where the Caesar comes from. I think that that's a natural thing. Sometimes when multi-party democracy becomes dysfunctional, you need a strong man to step in. This is why the Romans had, before the Caesars, the institution of the dictator. The dictator would basically take all powers to himself in times of national emergency, wars or insurrections, things like that, constitutional crises, and he would fix things. It's an institution that I think more and more people in the United States are going to be partial to, as it becomes apparent that liberal democracy is simply incapable of maintaining a decent society in the United States any longer. Now, as for Yaki, I think Yaki was an admirable person. He was a brilliant guy. I'm sure I would have enjoyed talking to him and knowing him, but I just don't agree with the basic arguments that he makes about the necessity of some European superstate. I just don't think the case has been made. So I respect him. He's an important figure. He's just not a figure that I agree with. I'm an ethno-nationalist. I don't believe in empires. So Gadius Maximus writes in with $10. Thank you. Do you consider White Identity Politics the third installment in a trilogy along with the White Nationalist Manifesto and Toward a New Nationalism? Not really a trilogy. White Identity Politics. Okay. The White Nationalist Manifesto is like a slender book that I wrote to try and communicate as many important ideas as we could about white nationalism to as large an audience as possible. And Toward a New Nationalism is kind of what I would call a companion volume to that. It contains a lot of essays that I wrote in the process of writing the manifesto. Some of them were part of the original outline, but then I just thought, no, this is getting too big. It would defeat the purpose. So I put a lot of stuff in there. So I look at Toward a New Nationalism as a companion volume to the White Nationalist Manifesto. White Identity Politics is something new. However, there will be a companion volume to it. And I haven't come up with the title of that yet, But the companion volume will contain some larger essays where I talk about people like Yoram Hazzoni and Francis Fukuyama, a lot of the people who are responding to white identity politics in the public, you know, public intellectuals, academics, and so forth, who are criticizing what we're doing. There's going to be a long essay about Kaufman's book, White Shift, and many other pieces that haven't yet appeared. But about half of that volume already exists. And you can sort of go back in the last couple of years at Countercurrents and kind of figure out what's going to go in there. So my discussion of Mark Lilla's book, The Once and Future Liberal, will go in there. My thing about William Galston's book, Anti-Pluralism, will go in there, and so forth. It'll be a fairly substantial volume, probably in the 250, maybe to 300 page range, about twice as many words and as white identity politics. So yeah, there will be a companion volume to white identity politics, and I've yet to come up with a good name for it. It might be something boring, frankly. I just haven't figured it out yet. And if anybody has any suggestions, that would be great. I love coming up with books. I love coming up with titles and then coming up with a book to fit it. One book that I'm going to put together as a collection of essays is going to have the title, In Your Heart, You Know I'm Right, just because I want to be the guy who brings out a book with that title. Okay, so let's check back at DLive and see if there are any more donations, comments, questions. Okay, so yes, we've got more donations here. Ludwig Michael has donated one ice cream and four lemons, and Waffen X has donated a diamond. Did you read Viktor Orban's response to Soros? I guess I haven't. I've read things that Orban has said about Soros. And at Countercurrents, there are a number of things that we reprinted in English by Orban, including a couple of speeches that he gave at these summer events that the Fidesz party was holding in Transylvania. Transylvania is part of Romania, at least it is right now, but it has more than a million, I think like 1.2, 1.3 million Hungarians living there. And so he goes there with the leaders of the Fidesz party and they do a summer school. Some of his speeches given there are things that I could sign my name to. I agree with him completely. The idea that a guy who is the head of a European nation is making statements like this is profoundly encouraging. I think he's the smartest politician in Europe, maybe the smartest in the world these days. And he's right on almost all the issues that matter to us. He's a crucial figure. And he's been willing to go head to head with Soros. Soros is the main guy who's promoting bad stuff in Hungary and all over the world. So I will look this up. If you can link it in the chat, I'd love to look it up. Krampus has donated another ice cream. Thank you. Visegrad needs nukes. Yeah, you know, no nuclear power has been attacked yet. That's a lesson that Gaddafi needed to learn. They never attacked Gaddafi until he said, I'm going to be a good boy and not go for weapons of mass destruction. Yeah. So people like Journey, people like New Order, it's great driving music. I really agree. Power is said to be more addictive than cocaine. Oddly enough, the cokeheads in the movement are also into all the power politics stuff. Our millennial woes and Endeavor Not Present. I'm sorry, I left that from, that's leftover from last week. I just didn't change that. My apologies. They came on last week. And 1984 is reductio ad absurdum. Yes, that's true. Greg is wrong about the center. Okay, whatever. Oh, this is Hunter Wallace. I'm probably not wrong about the center, but I don't know what you're talking about. So let's just move forward. Okay, Greg, do crypto donations get matched? Yes. If you do a crypto donation, it'll get matched. Write to me at editor at counter-currents.com. There is a crypto page. If you go to the donate page, the donate tab at Countercurrents, in fact, I can find that and share it with you right here if you give me a minute. There are various crypto options. Also, if you donate from Coinbase, Coinbase has blocked us for receiving crypto from them because they're run by a bunch of evil people. But of course, they don't know all of my addresses. They only know my addresses that are given on the website. So if you have a Coinbase account, what you need to do is get in touch with me and I can give you one of my many, many, many crypto addresses and that are unknown to Coinbase and the little weasels that run it. And you can send me money that way. And I'm pasting our donate tab there. And you can go there and there's info about crypto. But again, you can just go to counter-currents.com. We will take any crypto that you want to send, but we prefer Bitcoin. Bitcoin, Monero, Ethereum, whatever. I think we have four of them listed there, but there are other options that we're willing to take as well. We want your support however you want to give it and at whatever level you want to give it. We depend on that. It's what keeps us going. So let me just make another quick run over to Entropy because I don't want to miss out on anybody. And I have a couple other questions that have been jotted down here. Alexandra writes in, what can we do to get rid of the label hater for white nationalists? Okay, well, that's a good question. And the answer to that is we can't really do anything to get rid of that, short of controlling what people can say about us. And we don't have any control over that. The enemy loves to call us haters. Why do they do that? Well, they're counting on a lot of stuff. They're counting on people to be thoughtless, for one thing. They're counting on people to be sentimental and muddle-headed and think, well, love is good and hate is bad, right? They're counting on people to hear Obi-Wan Kenobi's voice in their head saying, don't give in to hate, Luke. That leads to the dark side and all that nonsense. When they say we're haters, that's an attempt to say that we don't have arguments for our positions. They're just based on emotions, right? And negative, bad emotions, and we shouldn't be taken seriously. It's all nonsense. It's just dumb. First of all, everybody hates somebody. The people who call us haters hate us. And we have to point that out. We have to point out that they're hypocrites. We have to impeach their credibility. The people who call us haters often will spit that word out in the most hateful tone possible. It's very, very easy to turn it right around at them and say, yeah, you hate us. We hate you. Do you want to know my reasons? That's the thing. We have to take it off the ground of emotions and into the ground of reasons and arguments. And we have to also rehabilitate the emotion of hate. It is just and rational to hate evil. It's just and rational to hate the things that destroy the things that you love. And if we are incapable of feeling hatred for evil or hatred for our enemies, then there's something wrong with us. We are not constituted right in the head. So I think what we have to do is twofold. Again, well, let's put it threefold. There are three things we need to do. One, impeach the credibility of the people who attack us on this stupid, spurious ground, the ground of hate, because they're haters too. Everybody's a hater. Second, rehabilitate hate. It's not a bad thing. It's a normal, natural, just human reaction to evil and enmity. And three, get it out of the realm of emotion into the realm of argument. We have reasons for the things that we believe. It's not just a matter of feeling. Another thing that we can say about this is we say, yeah, we're haters, but reluctantly. We don't want to hate people. We are ethno-nationalists. We want to actually come up with solutions to the hatred and violence that are endemic to diverse societies. Multiculturalism is an inherently hateful and violent ideology because it promotes conditions that are conducive to hatred and violence. Ethno-nationalism is a philosophy of love. It's a religion of peace. Why? Because it wants to drain the swamp in which hatred and violence breed, right? We want to separate peoples and give them their own homelands and their own systems of government so they don't have to compete with one another over scraps and power in the same system, which is one of the main causes of hatred. So we're not immune to the hatred that is endemic to diverse societies. We're not immune to it. And this is why I think it's intellectually dishonest for people like us to say, we don't hate anybody. It's just about love. If we claim that multiculturalism gives rise to ethnic hatred and violence, we cannot thereby claim in this practically the same breath that we somehow are immune to that, right? In fact, we're less immune to it than others. We're more sensitive to it than others, which is why we take the positions we do. We arrived at this position before a lot of our friends and relatives and co-ethnics have arrived at it, but they'll come around eventually because we're not monsters. We're just ahead of the curve, right? We're a little more sensitive to the consequences, the alienation, the negative effects of ethnic displacement and diversity. But everybody in principle can feel the same way. And eventually more and more people will feel the same way. More and more are feeling the same way, which is why things are going in our direction right now. So again, how do we respond to the charge of hate? Well, first of all, everybody hates somebody. These people hate us. Second, it's not just about feeling. It's about facts and it's about arguments. We have good arguments on our side. Hatred is an appropriate reaction to evil and enmity. And finally, we have to say that we're the ones with the political solution to the problem of hatred. The diversity mongers are creating more and more hatred and violence. We're the ones who have an alternative to that. So anyway, I think that basically covers all the questions that we've got. I'm going to give one more quick little run through. Hate is a human right. Well, yeah. and one of the things that's very, very damaging about the Bible, about Christianity, is that it says, it commands you, it makes a moral imperative to love people. Love your enemies like you love yourself. Well, I've tried that. You know, I've tried to command myself to feel certain things. And I don't know about you, your mileage may vary, but feelings don't just follow my commands. My feelings are somewhat independent of what I think and what I demand and what I think I ought to feel. And when you command people to love or to hate and they're not feeling it, what do you end up doing? Well, you just end up giving them some kind of incentive to fake it. And if people go through their lives faking their feelings, well, that's not a good thing. It's not a healthy thing. And so I can certainly say that it's a human right to feel what you feel. You might not want to act upon it. You might not want to share it with everybody, but it's certainly have a right to natural, normal human feelings, right? That just seems as analogous to saying you've got a right to eat human food and drink water and breathe air and have families and have friends. You've got a right to natural human feelings, the whole range of them. Now, you might not express them. If you feel anger, you certainly have to worry about just attacking people and so forth. But to say that you don't have the right to certain feelings is just the worst form of tyranny, and at best, it leads to phoniness. Okay, so folks, I want to thank you for doing this. I kind of prefer having another person on here, and this is why it's been a long time before I've actually gotten around to doing a solo AMA. But I think I'm going to do more of these in the future. We certainly had enough to talk about. I was thinking of doing it an hour. It's been an hour and 20 minutes now. So I want to thank everybody. I want to thank you for listening. I especially want to thank the people who are donating and who have given me questions and also comments in the chat. And I want to thank our moderators as well. So anyway, we will be back not a week from today, but a week from tomorrow. We'll be doing our normal Sunday live streams again. So thank you very much. And again, we will be back a week from tomorrow with another episode of Countercurrents Radio. Good night.